I need a Bellevue commissioner to say, call to order and say the time.
Oh, Tim Ma, call meeting to order. It is 6:31 p.m.
Great, thank you. So without further ado, this is Amadeo Guayo with Lunas Consulting, and she's going to do part one of our training today. Take it away.
Okay, thank you. And hello, magandang gabi sa iyong lahat. Good evening, everyone. My name is Amadeo Cruz Giao. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you to Alaric and to Brooke and the all the staff who've invited me to be with you all tonight. And tonight we're going to be talking about equitable grant making. And so I want to introduce myself a little bit before so you get to understand a little bit more of where I am coming from and who I am as a person. Because for me, deep equity really means not just about changing our structures, our policies and procedures, but also approaching the work in a radically different way, putting relationships first. And so with that, I want to share with you, I am currently work as an organizational healer, a consultant, and a teacher. I have over 20 years of experience supporting community-based organizations on Turtle Island, the continent known as the United States, and the Philippines, working with the most resilient and the most marginalized communities. I work mostly with Black and Brown communities and queer and trans folks as well. I am second generation Filipino-American, queer and non-binary, and I grew up on Coast Salish territories, mostly in Seattle. I use all pronouns, not just because I'm non-binary and dance between the genders, but also because in my native language of Tagalog, we don't use gendered pronouns. In fact, we only have one pronoun, it's siya, and we use it for all animate and inanimate objects, regardless of sex and gender, or if it's alive or if it's not alive, because we believe that everything has spirit and everything is alive. And so this is the framework from which I come into this work. And so I come from a line of community builders and healers. And I started and ran a community organization for many years in South Seattle called Zanu Healing. And these are some images from our glory years. And we served queer and trans, Black and Indigenous people of color, leaders, social justice leaders. And it was a leadership development organization using regenerative practices and access to nature as a pathway of healing. So I know intimately the struggles of being a founder and an executive director of a small grassroots organization, going from someone who just wanted to offer simple programs to support my communities to having to learn all of a sudden how to navigate the nonprofit industrial complex, to write grants, to speak to donors, to always educating folks, the ones who have money, right? On the dire issues facing the people that I care the most about. All of the high rates of mental illness, depression, the higher vulnerability to hate crimes, the inequitable access to economic opportunities and culturally relevant healthcare. How to translate this deep heart work to people who don't understand it, right? Into metrics and outcomes. And educating and proving our worth over and over as a community worth investing in. We started this organization 13 years ago, and this was before healing came into the framework of understanding of social justice, right? So it was so much education and it was exhausting. And I had to leave because it was taking too much of a toll on me financially and emotionally. I burned out. And I also wanted to continue my work, but do it in a way that I could impact on a larger scale and be able to work in the realms of philanthropy and social change. And so I went back to school and got two master's degrees from Brandeis. And it is funny what a bunch of letters after your name will do. It opened up a great opportunity for me and supercharged my expertise on healing and got people to take me seriously in a way that I never had been. And this is, and I'm a good, I think, example of implicit bias, right? People take me a lot more seriously now that I have an MBA and an MA right after my name. And also because of this newly found expertise, or rather newly validated, I've spent the last 4 years working in philanthropy, 2 years as a capacity building director at the Potlatch Fund, one of the only Native-run community foundations in the country, and supporting dozens of our grantee partners who are almost all very small community-based, many volunteer-run organizations supporting cultural regeneration, community building, Native arts and language, environmental justice, food justice, amongst many other issues that our Native brothers and sisters face in Northwest Indian country. And as a consultant in the past 2 years, I support foundations like Social Justice Fund, the Satterberg Foundation, and funders for LGBTQ issues on issues of healing justice. So this information that I am sharing comes not only from my experience in philanthropy, but from my deep experience as a member of the most marginalized communities in this country, from the trenches of being a grassroots organizer and a leader. So with that, let's talk about the meat of what we are here to do. So this is a two-part workshop. This is the first of two, and all Human Service Commissioners have been asked to either be here in person to this workshop or listen to the recording, and then have signed up for the second workshop, which is one of the 3 dates in later in May and in early, or I'm sorry, in later in April and early May. So I'll be covering a lot of ground in this first workshop. We've got folks who I know are in varying parts of their journey to understanding and implementing equity. And we've got new commissioners and also veteran ones who've been doing this for a while, from what it sounds like, and who know the drill. And because of the varying degrees of familiarity with this information, we're going to be covering a lot of big concepts and a lot of information in a very short amount of time, okay, to try to make it useful for the most folks. I'm guessing that a lot of it is review for many of you, but if not, then I encourage for those who are new to the information to do more research on your own, on any of the concepts that we're covering. There's an absolute abundance and wealth of information out there on every subject related to racial equity, to social justice, philanthropy, et cetera. Anything you can think of, we know it's been blogged about, YouTubed about, podcasted about. So I encourage you to do this good work on your own. And with a particular focus, I hope, on Black and Brown voices. So as I was saying, this first session is more of a lecture, and I apologize for that. This is not usually how I do things. I do a lot of community building in my teaching, but it just happened to be the way that we had to schedule it with everyone's super busy schedules and with 6 different commissions. So I thank you in advance for your good listening. And in the second session that you all signed up for, I promise, we're going to have more community building, and then you're going to have a chance to put these principles into action in a case study where we're going to be evaluating a sample grant application. But for today, we will be covering what is equitable grant making and in the bigger scheme of social justice philanthropy. And we'll do just a couple of very quick definitions and then talk about racial equity and why does race matter? Because to me, this is where we can have the biggest impact on the issues that are plaguing our country and our communities the most. And then we'll take a big picture look at the state of grant making and philanthropy. Who gets the dollars, right? And who makes the decisions around who gets the dollars? What kinds of organizations get supported and how? And then we'll start to go from this big picture to understanding, okay, well, how do we as decision makers in this process start to impact and embed equity in our decision making? So we'll look at implicit bias, and then we'll look at the best practices of equitable grant making from some of the best minds in the field. And then we'll end with question and answer. All right. Thank you for listening. Okay. So first, let's talk about equitable grant maker and in the bigger frame from which I come from. Equitable grant making, the ways that I speak about it, stems from the principles and values of social justice philanthropy, which seeks to transform philanthropy, the giving of money, right, to charitable causes towards redistribution rather than charity. It recognizes, and this is where it's very liberatory and revolutionary, it recognizes that how we even have access to the money that we're going to be giving away is in and of itself not just because of the extraction principles of capitalism, which we in the systems in which we work and transfer and hold money. And therefore, it is not us being charitable towards those who are quote-unquote in need, but rather in order to be fair and equitable, it is only fair to redistribute it because the ways in which it's accumulating and being hoarded is not fair. And so these principles that come from amazing organizations like Resource Generation, the different kinds of community foundations whom I spoke about, can inform how giving can be done in line with social justice values. So the first principle is that social justice giving focuses on systemic change that addresses the root causes of racial, economic, and environmental injustice and not just the symptoms. So what does that look like on the ground? For example, multi-year funding to organizations, creating public safety initiatives and working to defund the police rather than only responding after a murder has happened. The next is social justice giving centers the people who are the most impacted as key decision makers and respects their self-determination by giving with no strings attached. Much of philanthropic giving is only given for projects, right? There's not money for overhead. There's not money for administrative costs. It's not money for insurance, how to pay staff insurance and leave, et cetera, et cetera. And so, for example, that would look like giving general operating support to Black-led, Native-led, immigrant-led, et cetera, organizations that are powerfully positioned to have the best insight to the solutions that work best for their communities. In this frame, grant-making organizations strive to be accountable, transparent, and responsive in their grant-making. For example, having clear and simple compensated application processes, explicit funding criteria, and invitations for feedback from our grantee partners that help build strong relationships. It's relational, right? We understand that the folks who are doing the work are our partners. They're not a charity case. And that goes to our next point, that grant-making organizations act in solidarity with social justice movements by contributing not only money, but other resources like time, like knowledge, like skills and access to networks, social networks. For example, helping an organization fundraise or strengthening community campaigns that our grantees do by sharing any relevant connections, et cetera. So it's taking a broad look at resources and not just recognizing that money is the only resource. Time is a resource, right? Access to social networks, et cetera. And we'll talk more about that in a little bit. Okay. So let's define just a couple of things. So we all have been hearing so much about diversity, equity, and inclusion. I'll talk just a little bit about the difference between equity and equality. So equity at its base tries to understand and gives people and communities what they need to live full and healthy lives. Equality, and you can see this in this cartoon here, right? Equality is the one on the left. Everyone gets the same thing. But equity is actually what we need because equity, or rather equality can only work if everyone starts from the same place and needs the same things. And we know that in these unjust, oppressive systems, again, in which power and resource gets hoarded by certain groups of people, right, and the rest of us are fighting for scraps, right, we don't all start from the same place. So we actually need different things. And in this image on the right, giving the person in a wheelchair full access means giving them a ramp, right, building them a ramp. And the middle person gets more boxes because that's what they need to have access. And racial equity is the process of eliminating racial disparities and improving outcomes for everyone. It is the intentional and continual practice of changing policies and practices, systems and structures and culture by prioritizing measurable change in the lives of people of color. And so while I am going to be talking a lot about race and racial equity for good reasons, which I'm about to go into, there are, of course, so many other groups and identities that are marginalized in these systems. So this is not an exhaustive list by any means, but other groups and identities that we know are marginalized in these systems are immigrants, refugees and migrants, folks of differing sexual orientation, the LGBT community, people of differing genders, people of different religions, etc. And of course, as we know, through intersectionality, right, it's the combination of different identities that also compounds how we exist and receive both oppression and privilege based on our identities. Okay. So why focus on race? Because, very simply, all of the mountains of research and scholarships and studies done over literal decades shows us that race is one of the most reliable predictors of life outcomes across many areas, including life expectancy, income, wealth, physical and mental health, maternal mortality, et cetera, and the list goes on and on. Achieving results from our grant making that actually brings systemic change and not just Band-Aid solutions depends on bringing an intentional and explicit and sustained focus to addressing racial disparities across the problems we are trying to solve. And I will just go over these charts very quickly since I am hoping it is review for most of you. And again, if it's not, it's okay. There's tons of information out there that will show you this. So as we can see here, compared to white folks, African American business owners are 5.2 times more likely to be denied a loan, with everything being held constant, right? African Americans are also 2.3 times more likely to experience infant death. They are almost 3 times more likely to be searched on a traffic stop. And as we know, has been brought to the collective consciousness, this often leads to very deadly consequences. Black women also die 3 times more often giving birth, again, holding everything constant, socioeconomic and class constant, right? And so from wealth to employment, systemic racism leads to incredible disparities. The pandemic, as we know, has revealed that the most vulnerable are our Black and Brown community members who have experienced a higher likelihood of getting sick and dying from COVID, not just due to a lack of access to healthcare, but also because we make up disproportionately essential workers. We're more vulnerable. And also in terms of the recession are getting hit the hardest. As we can see here, disparities continue into every success indicator, from household income to employment to academic achievement to incarceration rates. Bottom line is that, unfortunately, as much as we wish that it were not true, race truly matters. And in research on field-based efforts, philanthropic efforts to combat complex social problems, some of philanthropy's biggest success stories when it comes to achieving population-level change, from teen smoking to teenage pregnancy to access to hospice and palliative care, they tell quite different stories when you disaggregate them, the results by race. So for instance, in 2001, only 7% of U.S. hospitals with 50 or more beds reported a palliative care team, so access to hospice care at end of life. However, what was really exciting is that the field has been super successful in helping to grow this number from 7% to 72% as of 2019. However, access and utilization have not been equitable across populations. Of the patients using hospice care in 2013, only 7% identified as Latino, Latinx, or Hispanic, and 8% identified as African American, both significantly lower than the representation in the overall population. And likewise, the U.S. teen birth rate has seen a dramatic drop of 70% since its peak in 1991. However, despite all the progress across all racial groups, right, as a whole, there are significant racial disparities in those teen birth rates today. While the rate for white teen girls is 13 births per 1,000 girls, teen girls of color have rates more than twice that, with 28 births per 1,000 for Black girls, 29 for Latinx girls, and 33 for Native Americans. The reasons for such differences are no doubt complicated by issues of race and class and access to healthcare and contraception. However, it's easy to look at this as a field, right, and see the overall drop in teen pregnancy and just assume that everything is better when it's not, that the problem has been solved. It hasn't. Again, the point is that race matters, and faced with the racial disparities of success in each of these fields, and the philanthropists who care about these issues are now having to play catch up. But, and what's really important as we're moving into thinking about grant making, is that if solutions had been designed from the very beginning with racial equity in mind, then today we may instead be seeing compelling and comparable results across all populations and not just for white folks. Okay. And, you know, an argument often is that equity, it's not fair to everyone, right? If other communities get more than the people who have more, right? And that's not true. Equity benefits everyone. So a good example of how designing for the most vulnerable groups often ends up benefiting all people can be seen in the use of the curb cut, which is the small ramp in the sidewalk that we see that was originally intended to help folks in wheelchairs. Pressured by disability advocates, the city of Berkeley installed its first curb cut in 1972. It wasn't the nation's first, but curb cuts were not common at that time. However, what was surprising was once the curb cuts were in place, the nation discovered that more than just the disabled benefited. The curb cuts became a favorite of parents pushing strollers, of workers pulling heavy carts, business travelers wheeling luggage, anyone suffering joint pain and knee pain, runners, bikers, and the list goes on. Angela Glover Blackwell, the founder of PolicyLink, has dubbed this the curb cut effect and challenges everyone to use it as a guide to achieve equitable impact. She argues that instead of seeing equity as a zero-sum game, as we often see and hear, right, that helping one group hurts another, the curb cut illustrates that when support is given where it is needed the most, then we all win. Likewise, if we don't intentionally address racial disparities that plague our nation, everyone loses because such disparity drags on the economic growth, the prosperity, and the well-being of all of us. Okay. So let's look at charitable giving. These are the latest numbers. And again, we're doing a big picture understanding of giving to put things in a perspective in terms of who gives how much money to which kinds of nonprofits, where the money goes. So let's take a look. So out of the $427 billion given in 2018, Giving USA, which tracks these numbers, shows that individuals gave the most in terms of the amount of money to nonprofits at 68%, with foundations and government giving about 18%. And so this 18% is what I'm going to be referring to as grant making. So in terms of a typical nonprofit's overall budget, most organizations have some kind of revenue mix that makes the most sense given their service area, their size, et cetera. And foundation and government grants make up a small percentage of that. And while we know that there is widespread acceptance of diversity, equity, and inclusion, all of the principles and the goals, we also know that the numbers show that distribution is not equitable. Despite changing demographics and increased awareness of the systemic impacts of racism and oppression, giving to communities of color has remained pretty static over time, despite overall growth in giving. We have seen, of course, a bump in that since 2020, since the global uprising. We still haven't seen any of the newest numbers for that, but the latest numbers show that less than 7% of grant dollars went to racial minorities, although they comprise 40% of the U.S. population. Only 6% of grant dollars went to people with disabilities, and they represent 12% of the population. Giving to immigrants and refugees has ranged from 0.6 to 1% of large foundation grants. And although foreign-born U.S. residents comprise more than 11% of the population. Okay. So another study has found that on average, the revenues of Black-led organizations are 24% smaller than the revenues of white-led counterparts. And when it comes to the holy grail of financial support, which is unrestricted funding that can be, again, used for anything, and it's not tied to a particular program, the picture is even bleaker. The unrestricted net assets of Black-led organizations are 76% smaller than their white-led counterparts. And the stark disparity in unrestricted assets is particularly startling because such funding in philanthropy often represents a proxy for trust. Okay. So why is there so much inequity in grant making? In their effort to ensure that grant dollars go towards effective organizations, many philanthropists have grant-making practices that actually perpetuate unequal distribution of funds. For example, traditional grant-making practice tends to favor organizations that already have existing relationships with funders, who have dedicated development staff, who have professional grant writers, right? And those who can maintain relationships with donors. They have larger budgets, larger staff. They have greater, in essence, greater organizational capacity, better positioning them to get access to funding. And these organizations also tend to be led by white folks. And organizations led by folks of color, we have been sounding the alarm about these disparities forever. Leaders of color, on average, have smaller budgets to work with and are more likely to report a lack of access to financial support from a variety of funding sources. Leaders of color also have inequitable access to social networks that enable connections to the philanthropic community. If we think about social networks, right, as we know, studies have shown that the people that we are in community with, the people that we are closest with, are pretty homogenous, right? And we'll do, I think we'll do an activity on that together. And so because of that, leaders of color don't have access to the same networks that white folks do, that white organizations tend to. Also, there's internal interpersonal bias that can often manifest as mistrust and microaggressions, which inhibit relationship building and emotionally burden leaders of color. It's really hard to explain the emotional burden it takes to keep going to foundations and donors, mostly white folks. Again, as someone, for example, like me, who is queer and brown and the child of immigrants, right? And to keep trying to explain why our communities matter, it takes a toll. And funders often lack understanding of culturally relevant approaches, leading them to over-rely on specific forms of evaluation and strategies that are familiar to them. Also, as a result, less funding, of course, will make its way towards smaller organizations, many of which may be serving similarly under-resourced communities. And of course, there's a lack of trust that our communities have the solutions to our own problems. So I'm going to quote Vule from the very popular blog Nonprofit AF and the former ED of Rooted in Vibrant Communities here in Seattle, who says, a major frustration, probably the major frustration that many of us grassroots organizations have, is that there seems to be a disbelief among many funders and other people in power that communities actually have the solutions to our own problems. The people and communities who have personal experiences dealing with society's entrenched problems should know more about it than those who have not. Okay, that's really powerful. So what can we do, and why is there this inequity? Because at its core, there are structural processes, there's culture, the deeply rooted cultural norms and structures, including racial, gender, ethnic, class, sexual orientation, and disability biases. So that brings us to implicit bias. So this is going to get heavy, and I know we've already gone through a whirlwind of information. So I want to actually invite you to take a deep breath and come back into your bodies. Again, so much of our work, this training, it can be so much in our head, and we need the fullness of who we are to deal with these problems that are plaguing us all. So I'm going to invite you, if it feels good to you, to do a little bit of stretching, however, whatever feels good to you, and maybe pull away from the computer a little bit and start to take deep breaths and start to wake up the body. Okay. Beautiful. Thank you, everyone. Deep breaths. Okay. Thank you all for your good listening. So grateful. Okay, so let's talk about implicit bias and implications in grant making. So we've learned about the importance of equity in grant making. So what do we do? You have been tasked with what we at Potlatch Fund would say is a very sacred duty, right? I remember Dana Arvizo, our executive director at Potlatch Fund, she said when we started looking over the grant applications that came from reservations all over Montana, Idaho, Oregon, Washington, right, with people's deepest wishes for their communities. She would say to us and remind us, this is, and the community members who made up our committees, to remember that it is sacred, that we are receiving people's prayers, we're receiving their deepest wishes, and hopes for their communities, right? And because of that, you have all been tasked with reviewing these grant applications and determining which organizations get funding and how much, right? And there's so many places and opportunities to make this process more equitable by learning about ourselves and how we make decisions, by learning about how the brain works and specifically about implicit bias. So let's talk about that and dive deep. Well, dive a little bit. You can dive deeper later. So the definition of implicit bias refers to the brain's automatic and instant association of stereotypes or attitudes toward particular groups without our conscious awareness. Okay. So implicit bias is evolutionary. The ability to distinguish friend from a predator, right, from enemies, helped our ancestors and the earliest humans to survive. It's this ability to quickly and automatically categorize people. That's a fundamental quality of the human mind. It saved our life on a daily basis, okay? So these categories give order to our life. And every day we automatically group people into categories based on social and other characteristics. So for example, we group people based on race, on gender, the way they look, the way they're speaking, right? All the cues that our unconscious mind is taking in all of the time. Implicit bias explains why, in recent years, we have seen a general decline in overly negative racial attitudes, meaning people are becoming less consciously racist. Right, despite and even with this, right, folks are becoming more, you know, embracing of other folks of differing race and gender, et cetera. But even despite this, there is continuation and increase of racial stratification in life outcomes and success indicators, and just as we saw in all of those charts, okay, on every, again, on incarceration rates, health, et cetera. And implicit or unconscious biases affect not only our perceptions, but also they guide our behavior, the things that we do on a daily basis, right? Our policies and our institutions. As the book, The Science of Equality, says, implicit bias and perception are often seen as individual problems, when in fact they are actual structural barriers to equality and equity. And studying implicit bias helps us to understand how we can embrace being more fair at a conscious level, again, less racist, right? And yet undermine fairness at the implicit and unconscious level. The implicit associations we hold don't even necessarily align with our declared beliefs or reflect stances that we would explicitly endorse. There have been studies of white women who were adamant about their lack of prejudice and racism, but then they were put into a room with a black man and then would automatically and unconsciously clutch their purse. Okay, this is, again, automatic. Your unconscious mind doesn't even know what it's doing, right? And this is because scientists demonstrate this bias as what is known as mental residue. Because implicit biases are pervasive, we all possess them. They are a part of what it means to be human. And we are often unaware of our implicit bias until we do the education and the exploration of our own. The latest science tells us that our unconscious dictates about 90 to 95% of our behavior, okay? And in general, we tend to hold implicit biases that favor our own in-group. However, research shows that we can still hold implicit biases against our own in-group, especially if we are marginalized, right? For example, I just recently took the implicit association test, which is going to be part of your homework, and found out, again, I've taken it several times over the years, again, found out that I still have a slightly moderate preference for white people, right? And it's because we live in white supremacy. We're getting bombarded with all of these narratives and images on the daily. So we all have them, and it is incumbent upon us to be mindful of how they're impacting our decisions. Because the good news is that while they can't really be changed, we can learn how to interrupt them and change our behavior. Implicit biases are not bad. They are what makes us human and able to process so much sensory information. But they can have negative outcomes for the groups of people who are marginalized because of them. And this is where we can learn how to interrupt and change. So some examples of implicit bias: doctors are less likely to prescribe life-saving care to black folks. This is, again, these are well-known studies. Another study found that female postdoctoral fellowship applicants had to be 2.5 times more productive than the average male applicant to receive the same competence score. Recent findings have shown that white researchers receive National Institutes of Health grants at nearly twice the rate that black researchers do. And also white managers are less likely to call back or hire members of a different ethnic group. Okay. And so these are two pictures. These are real articles from after Hurricane Katrina. So as you can see, there are three people doing the exact same thing, but one person is black, the top person, and the other two are below are white. And the descriptions of them are radically different, with the black person being described as looting and white folks, quote, finding bread and soda, okay? And these journalists, who are supposed to be fair-minded and unbiased, probably would not describe themselves as racist, and yet the outcome is actually racist, right? Another famous study in 2014 had researchers sending the exact same resume an application for a job opening. They had the exact same names, but one resume was Tom Meyer as a white person and another Tom Meyer who was black. Again, same application, same resume. The only difference was race. And as you can see how radically different the outcomes were. Tom Meyer as the white person was described as being generally a good writer, but needs to work on some things, has potential and good analytic skills. And Tom Meyer instead needs a lot of work and can't believe he went to NYU and is average at best. And in terms of the errors, Tom Meyer as the black person was found to have twice as many spelling grammar errors and much more technical writing errors, right? Exact same application. But again, implicit bias is working in the background to undermine our understandings of fairness, okay? So a lot of racial inequities occur without intention or malice, okay? It does not require races. Implicit bias helps us to explain how racism can be subtle in appearance, but significant in impact, especially when it comes to institutions, where the bias of individuals at every level is routinely replicated through collective decisions and actions, and it becomes compounded unless it is consciously counteracted. As the American Values Project says, implicit bias offers the idea that discrimination and bias are social, meaning they're learned, right, rather than individual issues. And thus, we can all participate in promoting equality and equity. Okay, so what does this have to do with grant making? In short, because of the way that decisions are made for who gets grants is social, right? You're going to be interacting with each other from what I understand. The way that we interpret reality is social, right? All of the cues exist in our environment. They exist in the language that we use, in the ways that we move our bodies, in the metaphors that we use, the stories that we tell, in media representation, etc. The unconscious is not just an individual or internal phenomenon. It is constantly interacting with the environment, taking in and absorbing like a sponge all of these cues. And social categories like race, gender, nationality, sexual orientation, etc., comprise some of the most powerful frames that operate at the subconscious level. And this environment helps to create and maintain our frames. And these are the frames that give rise to implicit bias. Again, so if you're only hanging out with the same kind of people, guess what? Most likely, you're all sharing similar implicit biases, right? And so it helps to, again, and we'll talk about the best practices to diversify who you're speaking with when you're going to be creating these decisions together. So how do we engage differently? The first step is to explore, identify, and acknowledge and act on implicit bias. Part of your homework between now and until I see you again is to take the implicit association test. It's from Harvard and the University of Washington. It's free. It is an ongoing study, so they're going to be using your results as part of their study. And again, I took it recently and was not shocked, of course, horribly disappointed to find that I still have a slight preference for white folks, which of course is not consciously at all what I would like to or ever want to cop to, right? And I want to stress again that instead of feeling bad or feeling like we're some kind of failure and not in integrity with our values, that we recognize that this is actually what it means to be human, right? And to overcome bias is so important to understand our own and learn how to interrupt it. So seeking education and learning and improving the conditions of decision making. Unconscious biases are a function of automaticity, okay? And so when we engage in deliberate and mindful processing, meaning slowing down our decisions, this prevents our implicit biases from kicking in and determining our behaviors. Next is setting goals to increase engagement, relationship and partnership building, and grant making in diverse communities. implicit bias is best detected when we use data to determine whether there are certain patterns of behavior that lead to racially disparate outcomes. And once we're aware of such a link, it's then possible to actually change it and see whether the outcomes are linked to bias. Next is monitoring and improving the environment. Again, because your environment both primes and helps to create these implicit associations, it's important to continuously monitor and improve it. And so with that, we try to involve a cross-section of diverse decision makers. Research shows that when we include a critical mass of marginalized folks in the decision-making process, that shakes up bias. And last but not least is convene, listen, and engage. So going to the source. It looks like there's something in chat, but I'm not able to read it. Sorry. Okay. Hopefully it'll pop up again.
I think you're good.
Okay. Thank you. So what that means is our communities, the most marginalized communities, are more than happy often to share our priorities, our needs, our challenges. And the best ways to meet communities is to go to where they are at, to conduct outreach, to make investments, to build their capacity that is right for their community. And through that process, you can also find ways to align that work with your values and your mission. Okay.
I'm sorry, Joyce had a question.
Okay, sure. Sorry,
Joyce,
go ahead.
I have a question. Joyce hit the wrong button on the bottom.
Okay.
Thank you.
Oh, okay. You don't have a question, yeah. Joyce? Okay. We have, there'll be hopefully time. I'll just try to run through this really quickly. And then we'll have a little bit of time for questions. So just some these best practices on equitable grant making. There are many, again, opportunities to address barriers throughout the whole process and include equity in the process. And where you as a group can make the biggest difference right now, of course, is in the decision making. But I do want to spend a little bit of time in talking about some of the things. So grant making strategy. It's great. It would be wonderful if you discuss with your group how much you would, at the very beginning, how much you would like equity to be incorporated in your priorities and in the criteria to assess grant applications. What would it tangibly look like, and how will you know that it's being incorporated? The next is designing a grant-making criteria that explicitly mitigates implicit bias and levels the playing field for smaller organizations, which may serve Black and Brown communities and are led and staffed by BIPOC folks, and use culturally responsive approaches, which may not be quote-unquote evidence-based. And discuss with your group how much risk are you willing to take. Maybe making, for example, something that can be very helpful is discussing upfront how much money do you want to set aside for funding smaller organizations that have lower capacity and potentially unstable finances. Okay, and then considering capacity building grants, including professional development. Next is recruitment and management of commissioners. One thing that we did at Potlatch Fund is we had a very community-based model. So we had folks from the community who we paid to be on the decision-making committees for each of the grant buckets that we gave to. So include the invitation for you all to think about possibly including one or more grantees and or beneficiary community members on the commission. And consider, of course, throughout this, the racial and ethnic and gender and income diversity of the board. And embed equity in documents and continue to train in equity principles. Next is applicant identification, polling grantees, community foundations, intermediary organizations who work with smaller organizations, community leaders, et cetera, to learn about strong grassroots organizations. Think creatively about other ways to find out about nonprofits by talking to leaders in those communities of interest. Okay. Let's see, I won't go through I'll go through a couple of them. Okay, so one thing that you can do is give smaller organizations additional time to submit applications. And also consider providing for organizations that have staff with limited English proficiency, consider providing language and cultural translation technical assistance with their grant applications. And also consider having at least one grant reviewer who is familiar with that culture or language. Okay, so this is where the rubber hits the road for all of you. So as you are making decision about grants to award, one thing that can be really helpful is to consider your overall portfolio and what it looks like and where there might be gaps in terms of diversity. For example, using a dashboard, displaying characteristics, and keeping the portfolio composition in mind as you make decisions. Portfolio characteristics, for example, could include percent of beneficiaries by race or by ethnic group, by age, by traumas experienced, by type of intervention, by geography, by income level, by sexual orientation, by gender, etc. And be aware about how your due diligence process may be biased towards well-resourced organizations with greater capacity. So again, deciding ahead of time to award a certain amount of money to smaller organizations. And this is really can be really important to comparing applications from smaller organizations against each other and not against larger, more well-resourced organizations, which most likely have professional grant writers on staff. I often shudder to think about how many times maybe my grant application as a tiny grassroots organization got put up against, you know, a bigger organization like ACRS, right? We would not compete, right? So you want to compare apples to apples. So beyond organization size, you can also bucket grant applications in other categories for comparison. Also be aware of how your process may favor evidence-based practices, okay? We know that many research studies traditionally focus on white populations and are not as inclusive as others. As a result, practices that are effective for underrepresented communities might not have a solid academic research evidence base to validate them, okay, but might have other types of evidence of effectiveness. For example, it's often felt so hard to describe in metrics and outcomes the success of our work at Xenu, which was often really intangible and couldn't be measured adequately. How can you share how we've changed people's lives by giving them access to spaces of healing or access to nature and their ancestors? And yet our community members told us every day how our work was impacting them so deeply and their work in the world. But that is hard to convey in dominant culture ways of thinking. It's not easy to show success because it is a totally different framework that's culturally rooted in our communities and outside of the realms of materialistic dominant culture. So think about the kinds of organizations that aren't taken seriously if that is the criteria of success. So many of the organizations that we support at Potlatch Fund connect folks to their ancestral life ways of art and language that offer meaning and purpose to their lives and deeply support their mental and spiritual health. And that is then translated to greater cultural identity, which then translate into impacting tribal sovereignty and political autonomy. But that is really hard to measure, right? So think about that as you're making your decisions. Also, we are going to be providing a temporary scorecard and scoring rubric that will help you to, as a first cut in prioritizing applications. But we really want to make sure that it's balanced and making sure that you provide nuanced and thoughtful comments on the applications as well. So finding that balance. And then also communicating directly with applicants when you have questions about their applications. Set up quick phone calls if you need to understand their circumstances or you have a question about their budget. It's not hard, right? As well as hearing from them, you have an opportunity to hear from them about what makes their application unique or innovative and how they are working to address their community's needs. And last but not least, give honest feedback to organizations on their applications out of respect for their time that they invested in applying. This is going to help them build their grant writing capacity for future grant applications. Okay. So I'm going to take a deep breath. We only have a few more minutes. Thank you so much for listening. That is the end of my presentation. And we do have just a few more minutes if folks have any questions before we end. Thank you so much for listening. I know that was a ton of information. Anyone have any questions?
Go ahead.
Thank you so much for this presentation. And it's a question for my own curiosity. When we're talking about the differences in grant allocation across the minority population and people with disability, and also immigrants, I think it was 7% to minority, less than 6% to people with disability, and less than 1% to immigrants.
Yeah.
Do you by any chance have the proportion of those same population that have applied for those grants?
For the grants for you all? No, I don't. Yeah, you would have to go to, I think, the staff member that,
okay.
Yeah. But that's a really good question. Again, that's super important as we're thinking about creating change, right, is to have some kind of dashboard. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. Any other questions? Okay. Well, thank you, everyone, for your attentive listening. I know it was a ton. I think I've stunned you into silence. So, and it's all important. So thank you so much. I will be sending an email to be sent to all of you with a couple of things of homework along with these slides. And the homework for before our next session is just going to be to look over a quick video and to take an implicit bias test. It's so powerful. And then I'll be seeing you again soon where we get to build community and put these principles into action, into practice. And I'm really looking forward to that. So
thank you
everyone.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah,
thank you everyone.
And then I just need a Bellevue commissioner to
address. This is Samere. Can you hear me?
Yep. Yes. Can.
Okay, wonderful. My audio problem is fixed. So thank you so much for the great training. I really enjoyed it. And it's 7:29 and I adjourn the meeting. Thank you.
Great.
Thank you. Take care, everyone.
Double ourselves out. Thank you, everyone. Bye. See you soon.
Thank you so much. It was a wonderful presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.